On the half shell, they're the heroes for. In this day and age, who could ask for more? The crime wave is high with fucking mysterious.
This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
To a totally tubular episode of Junk Food Cinema right here on FilmSchoolRejects.com. You knew it was coming.
T-U-R-T-L-E
power.
T-U-R-T-L-E power.
T-U-R-T-L-E power. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. No idea what we're talking about today. We have kept it securely under wraps.
I almost tweeted about this last night because I looked up the IMDb description.
Uh-huh.
And it was one of those where I kind of wanted to cut it out and post it and go, name this movie by its description. It said, a group of teenage Ninja Turtles, which were mutated from green goo, team up with a news reporter to save the day.
That's it.
It's like, yeah, that's...
End of story. That's, so
we are,
yeah.
But... Which Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles are we talking about? Are we talking about the recent one? Are we talking about the 2007? We are talking about the 1990.
Yeah, I'll give you a hint. We are not talking about the Michael Bay Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, as it turns out. We are, however, the weekly cult and exploitation film cast that tastes even better than a fresh slice of pizza. So good, it just has to be fattening. I am Brian Salisbury. He is C. Robert Cargill.
And together, we are Junk Food Cinema.
We are going to talk about our favorite greasy movies, our favorite movies that are devoid of nutritional subtext, because...
Sometimes.
Just for the shell of it, I think you might say. And don't worry.
You might not say.
Don't worry. There will be plenty more of those puns.
No,
won't. As this goes on. Because you know what? That's... If the movie endorses that low level of comedy, I feel like in order to be... faithful to the film of which we are speaking, we must also lower our standards of comedy and make jokes like that. So I've been preparing for this episode for the last 10 years of my life. So
this is true.
Yeah, so we have arrived here at, as Cargill said, 1990s Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. And before we poke our heads out of the sewers, I just want to remind you that you can find our back catalog on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can also follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema and like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. If you find it totally bodacious, you can go to patreon.com/junkfoodcinema and become a patron for as little as $4 a month. Now, that is way less than your parents spent on all those fucking action figures when these guys were huge, and you know it. So $4 a month gets you access to all of our bonus content. Definitely consider becoming a patron. Now, getting into the meat of today's episode, 1990s Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Okay, so this is another one of those episodes that was a long time coming.
Like, yes.
This is, for what we do, for what we've talked about, especially over the past year, this is one of those essential pieces of cinema. Now, some of you out there may wince at that.
You may tuck your head in at the notion of this being called
God
cinema.
Damn it, Brian.
Oh, just keep setting me up,
this
baby.
This is going to keep happening.
Just keep setting me up, Splinter.
No, in order to really kind of wrap your mind around what this movie is, because it does hold a couple special places in movie history. You have to understand what the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles are. Now, that sounds like a silly statement.
They are teenage, they are mutant, they are ninjas, and, get this, turtles.
Yes, but the thing is how they started is not remotely close to where how they ended up, and it's amazing how it happened. Of course, the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles started out as a 4-issue limited series, a comic series in the mid-80s, the early to mid-80s. And what it was a reaction to what the pop culture was at the time. It was not a straight comic. It was not meant to be taken seriously. It was satire. And it was making fun of a couple different things. Of course, you go back to the early 60s and the creation of the X-Men. And when when Stanley created the X-Men, he's admitted several times publicly that the reason they invented mutants was because they were tired of having to come up with explanations for why people got superpowers. They were running out of ideas. They were coming up with comics faster than they could, you know, put them out. But they had to keep coming up with, well, he was exposed to a gamma bomb, or they flew into space and were exposed to gamma radiation, or they were bit by a gamma irradiated spider. And eventually they were like, you know, we got to kind of drop this gamma thing. And so they created mutants. And that was kind of a big deal. And the X-Men, though, were not as big a deal. They were not a huge comic. They were not big time. And eventually they got canceled. And in the mid-70s, they decided to relaunch it, and they hired a young writer named Chris Claremont to come in and revitalize it. And almost overnight, he turned this, by restarting the comic and creating a new team of X-Men, he created what would become the number one comic in the world during the 80s and 90s. It outsold Batman. It outsold Superman. And it was so popular at the time that mutants started popping up all throughout the Marvel universe.
And I was still right there to take credit for it. Excelsior.
At the same time, we had in we had the, you know, Frank Miller doing some Daredevil. You had the Daredevil run that included this group called The Hand. And these were some really great runs of Daredevil, also very popular. And you had an invasion of Orientalism. And this is something that you and I have kicked around doing. We sat down to do an episode on this years ago, and it never came to fruition. We ended up not doing the episode. We were going to do an episode on 80s ninja films.
Oh, yes.
And you and I sat down for one Sunday with, you know, a case of beer and sat and watched like all the great, terrible 80s ninja films. Some of which you had never seen.
Yep.
And so it was a treat to introduce you to that. Well, that was just, that had invaded the pop culture. And so what Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles was a reaction to the pop culture of the early 80s and making fun of it and doing a very tongue-in-cheek kind of razzing of all of these really popular ideas all at once by mashing them all together and being, well, they're Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. So it became incredibly popular. It was a black and white comic in its first run, and it was super cool. It was super edgy. It was really hip. It was really violent. And so it started doing really well, and one of the guys of the team realized...
Now the team being Laird and Eastman?
Yes.
Okay.
Realized that there was a gold mine here. And took the property to an ad agency and said, we want to develop this into kids' toys and cartoons. Can you help develop that? And so they sat down and retooled the Ninja Turtles by reacting to the era that was going on. Now, this is how this ties into what I was talking about at the beginning of the podcast with, you know, how it ties in over what we've talked about in the last year. As we talked about last summer, 1986 was this line of demarcation. It was a line in the sand between Hollywood taking genre seriously and then it shuffling it under the rug as mainstream audiences stopped coming out for a lot of genre fare. And what happened was that even though mainstream audiences weren't going to big budget genre movies anymore, our generation had grown up on them. We loved this stuff and we wanted it. And so they started marketing this to kids. And there's this very weird narrow window of time that this falls into where we were getting ultra-violent properties turned into kid shows.
Oh, yes, the Rambo cartoons.
The Rambo cartoon, the Toxic Avenger cartoon, yes. The RoboCop cartoon. All of these R-rated properties were turned into fucking Saturday morning kids cartoons. And that's what they did with Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. They took this violent black-and-white comic and turned it into cowabunga. And this ad agency added the catchphrases and the radicals and changed the headbands in the original comic.
They were all red.
Mm-hmm. And they gave each one their own headband so the kids could tell them all apart.
So you had to buy four of them and not just one.
They added the pizza. Mm-hmm. That was another thing that the ad agency added. All the affectations that you think of with the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles really came out of this ad agency that was like, this is what kids want right now. And so they created a cartoon that was based off a comic that was a reaction to the early 80s. And the cartoon was a reaction to what was happening in the late 80s.
I just imagine an elderly Don Draper sitting there and being like, the answer is pizza.
The answer is, yeah, it's a, you know what, there,
I'm smoking
sure
a cigarette.
I'm sure there is that guy, and I'm sure that guy made a lot of money off that and is still to this day living off of what he calls his pizza money for coming up with the pizza idea. But so it's this comic and this cartoon has such this weird place in history that it is reflecting two different eras on the different side of 1986. And it fascinates me. And it was so instantly popular as a cartoon and a toy line that it was a no-brainer to make a movie, but Hollywood was not really on board with it.
Yeah.
So they raised the money independently and funded what would become the most successful independent film to that date. Like, this was more successful than Halloween was, and would not be... that they would not lose that place until the indie boom a few years later. And you had movies like Pulp Fiction that would cross the $100 million mark. It was, for a while, the most successful independent film ever made.
Yeah.
And it's such a weird reflection of the few years before it and not representative of the movies that would then come after it in the 90s.
Yeah, not representative of the movies that would come after it. Not entirely representative, but not entirely... doing a disservice to the comic book origins, and very different from the cartoon that really was sort of the inspiration for doing the movie in the first place. So the cartoon was massively successful. So yeah, it is a weird, much like the four characters, the four titular characters, it is a very weird creature, this movie. Just a quick list of every studio that turned this movie down. Walt Disney, Columbia, MGM, Orion, Paramount, even though Paramount is owned by Viacom, that bought Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles in 2009. So it's kind of funny. It's like, they're like, we're not missing this again. And then, of course, Warner Brothers. So they brought it to New Line. And if you notice in the opening credits of this movie, one of the other big producers is Golden Harvest.
Yep.
A company that a lot of us movie geeks know for making martial arts films. Like, if you saw Golden Harvest or Shaco before a Kung Fu movie, it's like, oh, this is one of the good ones.
This is one of the big ones.
Yeah. Golden Harvest usually be a Jackie Chan movie. To the best of my recollection, every time I saw Golden Harvest as a youngster, it was like it was a Jackie Chan movie that was about to start. A little bit about sort of the... I understand entirely that this is an episode that is going to be drenched in personal nostalgia. Cargill's kind of talked a little bit about the comic book, and that's where you came in, was at the ground floor comic book level. I came in 1990. I was a kid obsessed with the cartoon and obsessed with the toys. I had fucking just... You remember, they don't make these kind of things anymore, but they used to make action figure, like vinyl action figure cases that were just... They weren't individual compartments. They were just like two massive shelves on each side, and you would just throw in like a carpetbagger suitcase all of the action figures. They had them for Masters of the Universe. They had them for those like 12-inch wrestling figures, and they had them for Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and I had about three of those motherfuckers. I loved these action figures, and particularly because they were weird and gross. Like, they would take all the creepiest animals, like Baxter Stockman was a human fly, and then you had Leatherhead, who was this weird-looking alligator, and you had the Rat King. Fucking Rat King! I will never forget that action figure had little tiny plastic spiders just stuck all over his head, and you really got the sense that this was a character who lived in the sewers, and Mondo Gecko was this creepy-looking lizard with a skateboard, and like all of these fucking amazingly weird, gross action figures. And I look at it, and I was obsessed with them. And then I was obsessed with the cartoon. And I remember when the movie came out, I didn't get to see it in theaters, but I happened to be at the store one day with my grandmother and saw that it was on VHS, and she bought it for me. And I perceived that, and it was that FHE, Family Home Entertainment, that had put out all of the cassette tapes of the cartoon. So I knew that logo immediately. I saw that it was the Turtles. I was so excited. I proceeded to wear that tape into oblivion. So I was like, the Turtles were huge for me as a kid. Massively important to my childhood.
Yeah, same here. And in both ways, because the thing is when the cartoon happened, it was like, holy shit, now I can watch a cartoon of this. This is great. Mm-hmm. Like up until this point, like you had the comics, which were coming out sporadically. Like it had a very... they were not on a normal release schedule. They're in true indie comic fashion. It would go a couple months between issues. And then of course there was the famous role-playing game that Palladium put out, which was still using the comic book art, because none of that other stuff had happened yet. So the cartoon came out, and I was just a hair too old for cartoons at the time. Like this is when it came out, I had just entered middle school and cartoons were for kiddies, and yet I was like, fuck that, I'm watching Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. This is fucking great. It was very much something that I was super into, and so of course went and saw the movie in the theater a couple of times, which is oddly enough, this movie is where I fell in love with Elias Koteas.
Oh my god, Elias Koteas in this movie.
Yeah, and we'll get to that, but seeing that every time he showed up in a movie after that, I'm like, holy shit, it's Elias Koteas. And my friends would be like, who? And I'm like, it's Casey Jones, fuck you. and they'd be like, oh yeah. It was kind of a touchstone. Another weird thing is this movie came out just at the end of rap being mostly hip hop. Mm-hmm. Gangster rap had not really exploded. You know, we did, you know, it had come out, but it had not bled entirely into the mainstream. So there was still that kind of, you could be badass while doing MC Hammer style music in the mainstream, and it had not died off yet. So you get this very rap driven soundtrack sold to kids in a way that you couldn't in 1994.
Yeah.
And so it is just drenched in that era and drenched in our childhood.
Yeah.
It was one of those movies that we keep throwing around, like, we got to do Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles at some point, because there's so much good and bad to talk about with this movie.
And that's what's crazy is, even though there is this amount of nostalgia, even though I was the kid who, when I turned six, I was actually really sick and I couldn't have a birthday party because I was contagious, and my parents were actually out of town. And so my grandmother and my aunt took me to Target like the day before my birthday and just let me pick out whatever I wanted as gifts. But then they still like wrapped them all the next day and like made me a cake and like decorated the whole house kind of thing. So it was like a birthday party for just me. But everything was Ninja Turtles. The cake, every single gift, the plates, the games that we played, everything was fucking Ninja Turtles.
Are you saying they threw a shell of a party?
I am saying that, and thank you for putting it that way. That is the most apt way to put it, and I'm glad you're on board for this. Oh, I love it. It's like you know, you making those jokes is like a turtle poking its head out just to make sure everything's
okay. Well,
look,
because that's the thing about this movie is this movie never stops with that. You could actually set your watch. They make sure to make one turtle pun like every 5 minutes.
Yes.
It's so weird in that way. That one of the other things that really caught me off guard, because I have not watched this in maybe, oh God, I'm looking at like 13, 14 years. I remember the Draft House showed it at midnight one night, and the whole Ain't It Cool crew showed up, and not having talked to one another, we were
speaking
just all
of coming
there.
Out of the sewers. Am I right?
Yeah. But we were all like, what are you guys doing here? And they're like, we're big Ninja Turtle fans. It's like, fuck yeah, we are. And had a blast that night, and the you know, credits came up and the crowd is singing along, and it was like one of those first big nostalgia screenings that I had seen at the Draft House. Like normally they were showing like really hip, edgy, cool, you know, stuff from the past, and here they were showing Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and everybody was fucking into it. But as I was speaking about earlier, this is, you know, a property that was refined by an ad company, and you can feel that in the writing of this script. Like, they're constantly cracking jokes, and that's the worst part of this movie.
And yet, it's not, like, it gets so much worse in the sequels.
Well, yeah, but no, but here's what's bad and weird about this movie is that of all the stuff that really works, and we'll go into this because there's stuff that really works in this. Most of the jokes are just pop culture references, and they're pop culture references that are incredibly dated. Like, there's a Vanna White reference. There's a Mike Tyson reference.
There is, running through the entirety of this franchise, references to Humphrey Bogart.
Yes.
Why? Why Humphrey Bogart?
Well, because in the 80s, Humphrey Bogart had had a resurgence in popularity, and it was nostalgia to look back on Humphrey Bogart.
What? Why him specifically?
Because he was fucking Humphrey Bogart.
No, I understand that he's a very cool motherfucker, and when I grow up, I want to be Rick from Casablanca. I get that. But why
did everyone in the 80s?
That's so strange to me.
It's, yeah, no, it was, he was the, well, yeah, there was that nostalgia for lost celebrities in the 80s. Like, there's a very famous painting, Nighthawks. And throughout the late 80s and early 90s, there was a very famous riff on it that you could buy in, like, every Spencer's Gifts, which was Nighthawks with James Dean, Marilyn Monroe, and Humphrey Bogart, and Elvis as the four characters in the Nighthawks painting. And it is, those were the big four, you know, celebrities that everyone kind of pined for, and Bogart was one of them. And yeah, there's some Bogart references in here. There's a Cagney reference in here that is the famous misquote of Cagney, that Cagney never said "you dirty rat," but that's the entirety of the impression in this movie.
Yeah.
But yeah, you could literally, as you watch through this, it's constant references to things that were popular in 1990. There's a moonlighting joke. Like, there's like the Casey Jones and April O'Neil have a spat and go into separate rooms, and somebody says, "This is like moonlighting." Like, these are jokes that do not stand the test of time. Aren't really jokes as much as they're like what people complain about Family Guy, where it's like, these aren't jokes. You're saying the names of things.
You think that's bad. No, it's true. But it was one of those things like, well, parents have to sit through this too, so we're going to give them something that they'll think is funny. But at the same time, what I like about this movie to this day, and what skirts around just this being a nostalgia trip for me, is that there's some heavy shit in this movie. The content of the story goes incredibly dark at times. And I understand, yes, that's what the comic was. But so much of the rest of this movie, as we've said, is like a lot of lighthearted puns, and they're constantly doing the surfer lingo. And it's like there are moments in the dialogue that feel very juvenile. But then one of the turtles gets beaten almost to death.
Yes.
And like they basically throw him in a bathtub and just hope that he wakes up again.
Well, this is one of those weird things about the Ninja Turtles, something that is both good and bad. There are two Ninja Turtles that have genuine personalities, and then you have the jokesters. And the thing is that, again, going back to its comic roots, Leonardo and Raphael are based very heavily on Cyclops and Wolverine, where Leonardo is the noble leader bearing the burden of leadership with the Turtles, just like many of the Cyclops arcs of the late 70s and early 80s. And then you have Raphael as the Wolverine character, the really violent guy who's a loner. He goes off by himself all the time. He leaves the team constantly and then comes back at just the right time. He has anger issues. And you have these two characters that are very well developed in this movie. And then you have Michelangelo and Donatello, who really are almost indiscernible from one another in this movie. Like, in the comics and in the cartoon, they have slightly more development, but their development never really resonated the way that Roth and Leo do.
See, as I understand it, Leonardo leads, and then Donatello does machines. Raphael is cool but rude, and Michelangelo is a party dude. Heroes in a half shell. I mean, in the opening song, they break down the taxonomy of the Ninja Turtles. Whereas I will say in this movie, you're right. The personality, if you were to listen to this movie and not actually watch it, you would not know which turtle was speaking unless it was Corey Feldman.
Unless it was Corey Feldman.
But yes. The other three, like their voices, you're like, wait, who's
I don't know. I don't know. I don't know that that's true because Raphael inexplicably has this kind of half Brooklyn accent.
Oh, he's super New York.
But they can't figure out which part of New York. Like, it's a mix.
No, that's inconsistent throughout the movie. Sometimes he talks like that. He's like, about a 5-minute misconduct for Ruffin Pal. And it's like, okay, he's very New York. And then other times it's like, if he's saying something that's just a random throwaway line, it's almost like someone else dubbed it for him because it just does not sound the same. So it's very inconsistent. But at the same time, what I like about the first movie is that, and maybe this is just me being nitpicky, but like they actually try to be ninjas. Like they actually try to work in the dark and, you know, disappear without a trace. And that does not fucking happen in that second one. That second one, like, in the first, the introduction to the turtles in this movie is April's about to get jumped, a Psy comes flying through the air, knocks the light out, and then you just hear fight sounds, and then they've already vanished by the time the lights come back on. Contrary to the second movie where their introduction is, we walked across the street and down some stairs, and now we're here. It's like, you just walked over here. You literally just crossed the street as turtles and just walked into this fight. There's no attempt whatsoever to operate in the shadows.
Well, I mean, if we're going to mention the second one, keep in mind, is a movie that its theme song is done by Vanilla Ice. Like, yeah. There's no better metaphor for the second turtle movie than the fact that it's led by, you know, Vanilla Ice music. Like, yeah, that is, it's very much everything that was going wrong in the early 90s.
It is a vanilla movie. But you need to talk about the second movie to understand things about this movie. And one of the things to understand about this movie is, whether you like or hate this movie, you have to give props to Jim Henson production, Jim Henson's workshop.
Oh, yes.
The actual creation of these turtles, the suits that were built, the animatronics in the heads to make the faces expressive.
And while, not just the turtles, but Splinter.
And Splinter operated, one of the three people operating him was Kevin Clash. So, I mean, you have these amazing, like just absolutely amazing creations that Jim Henson brought to life. And then they made them big, because in the comics, they're only 3 to 4 feet tall.
Yeah.
They made them human size so that they could put actual martial arts stunt performers in these suits so that they could be fighting, you know, Ninja Turtles.
One of whom, of course, was at the time a young star, Ernie Reyes Jr.
Yeah, who did so well filling in for the stuntman who was doing Donatello when he got injured that they actually gave him a leading role in the second one as Kino. But the thing that irked Jim Henson was, And this is crazy because it wasn't just Henson, but there were many people who felt this way about the first movie, is that they felt it was too violent. And that's kind of crazy to me because the violence in this movie is like an episode of Power Rangers. You know what I mean? Like nobody, like everybody's got weapons. Nobody, like Leonardo's got two swords. No one's getting anything cut off. There's no blood. Like it's just like kicks and punches and like very, to me, what feels like very tame violence. But Jim Henson had a real problem with it. And the only reason he agreed to let his creations be used in the movie is because the director of this film had previously worked for him. The director, Steve Barron, has a really interesting story. In the 80s, he was directing music videos, and when you list the videos that he directed, it sounds like you're listing tracks off a great 80s compilation CD, because it's like, oh, I don't know, just Fascination by the Human League, Billie Jean by Michael Jackson, Take on Me by A-ha, Money for Nothing by the Dire Straits, like really fucking like memorable videos from the 80s.
Really memorable videos. Yeah. Like those are some of the classic videos. Billie Jean fucking melted brains when it came out. So did Take On Me. Mm-hmm. And I can't tell you how many times I saw the Dire Straits video. That, I mean, it's just, those were all just like he had computer animation in a video. Like what's going on here? Yeah. And his direction on this is really good. Yeah. Like, the thing is that one of the things that impresses me about this is you can really tell how tightly he was working with Henson Workshop.
And that's a product of the fact that after doing music videos, the very next thing he did was three episodes of Jim Henson's The Storyteller.
Yeah.
So that's how they kind of, you know, got acquainted with each other.
And most of this movie is shot in the dark. Mm-hmm. Like, they shoot these in these very dimly lit areas to help cover for any of the mistakes with the puppeteering, you know, with the suits, and help it make it more realistic. But it makes for a very moody, cool, noirish martial arts movie. Interestingly enough, the second unit director on this was Brian Henson, who would go on to take over, you know, Henson Studios after his father passed. And so many of the shots that, you know, are just, you know, stuntmen or shots of the puppets and things like that were done by Brian Henson. So this had an incredible amount of talent behind the camera in the puppeteering department, which was just amazing. Like, I mean, the things that this crew did during this period of time are fucking legendary. Like, these people were fucking brilliant. And this is one of those great examples that nobody was doing stuff like this. Like, no one, like, there's stories, listen to Peter Weller talk about being in RoboCop, which was just, you know, a few years before this. And in the original script of RoboCop, he moved like Spider-Man. Like, he was quick, he was fast, he was more than human. But the minute they put on all the gear, he couldn't move at all. Mm-hmm. Like, he just couldn't, move normally. He looked silly. It was going to kill the whole movie. And then they decided to shift it and make him slow and robotic. So Peter Weller learned how to move like a robot, fashion that movement, but they could not get that to work like that. And here you have Henson Studios within just a couple of years, putting guys in full fucking turtle suits,
yeah,
and putting them in actual martial arts sequences and making it work and making the turtles look like they could move and making Splinter look like a very real, like, there are some surreal moments in this movie where you're watching like human beings interact with Splinter and you just get that sense of how fucking weird this has to be for these people. Like, here's this giant rat thing that's talking to them.
Yeah.
What the actual fuck is going on here?
Yeah.
It has this weird, perfect sweet spot of the uncanny valley that,
yeah,
you can tell it's not real, and at the same time, it feels fully real.
And that's the thing that I am so much more in favor, and I think it's so much more effective in a movie when characters can have an emotional connection and the audience can have an emotional connection with something that is physically present in the room. To me, that is so much more important than a character who can jump and flip and move really quickly. I mean, to me, the difference between the new CG Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles in this movie is the same as the difference between the Frank Oz Yoda puppet and the Yoda that flips and fights Count Dooku in episode 2. It's like, yeah, I mean, I guess it's cool that he's fighting, but like, when I just see that Yoda in the prequels, I feel nothing. I felt so much more of a connection with a goddamn puppet,
yeah,
in Empire Strikes Back. And that's exactly what we have here is, you're right,
it's tactile.
Exactly.
It reflects the light.
Yes, yes.
It's clearly there.
It has weight. It has depth. It has dimension. It's
you
an actual fucking thing.
Land.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And I think the work that is done, like 90% of the universal appeal of this movie for people that have never watched the cartoon, never collected one of the toys, have any interest at all, the universal appeal, 90% of it in this movie, is how good a job the Henson Studio did on the actual Turtles and on Splinter.
And the other 10% is Elias Koteas.
Let's not kid ourselves, guys. Him as Casey Jones is fucking perfect.
Now, you guys mind telling me what you're doing with my little green pal over there?
Who the heck is that? Wayne Gretzky? On steroids?
And how they deal with Casey Jones in this one, it was really interesting because they really nailed the look of Casey Jones in this, like from the comic and from the cartoon. Like it was, they really kind of solidly, they show both, they're showing both his origin in the movie and they're getting his look down. It's funny because when he showed up in the original comic, you know, he's got the golf bag full of just all sorts of weapons, including golf clubs. And here in the movie, they're showing the origin of him using the golf clubs.
Yeah.
Which is a cute little nod for fans.
He's like if Charles Bronson in Death Wish got really into going like to Dick's Sporting Goods or something. You know, he's this New York vigilante. And actually, that's my favorite part of the first time they meet each other, is it's almost like a get off my turf conversation.
Oh, that's exactly what it is.
Where it's like, no. The only person who's going to be like, Raphael is incensed that Casey Jones thinks that he has the right to punish criminals. It's like, no. You know, Casey Jones says, like, these guys need to be taught a lesson. Raphael says, not like that and not from you.
Look, I don't want to fight you.
Well, tough rocks, pal.
A Jose Canseco bat? Tell me, you didn't pay money for this.
And it's like, shit. This is a turf war going on right now.
Yeah. And this is one of my favorite storytelling tropes. And this is one of the things that works about this movie. This movie is one of those that is structured pretty well. It has like two slow spots that are slow for like 3 minutes. But
that's true.
But the structure of it does several of my favorite things that you see in films. And this one does the putting two enemies together and having that defeat at the hand of one of those enemies. And then the moment where that enemy shows up and says, hey, why are you messing with my friend? Like that fight, they bonded in a way, and it crystallizes when he sees that this guy's fighting the same guys that he's fighting. And it's like, oh shit, we're on the same side. Well, let me show up and kick some ass.
Yeah.
And the moment they start fighting together as a team is one of those fist in the air moments where it's like, fuck yeah, Casey Jones is with the Turtles. Like they very easily could have dragged that out longer. And instead, he joins up with them very early in such a great way, in such a fun sequence that you just want to see him hang out forever. And this is one of the... Elias Koteas is an actor we've mentioned several times on this podcast before, and we'll probably mention a few times more. He's got a couple other classic great genre treats.
Oh, for sure.
In his profile. But he does a lot of the heavy lifting in this movie because with these characters that you know are emoting just as puppets, you need someone who really connects with them as humans. And you have April O'Neil and you have Casey Jones, but Casey Jones is the one through, like, April O'Neil, like, very quickly, you know, has the classic I'm freaking out, I'm not dreaming, am I moment, and then is all of a sudden best friends with them. But Elias Koteas is constantly sparring with the Turtles, like both physically and through barbs, and allows for that development through conflict and for the Turtles to become even more real to us because he thinks they're real.
Right.
And he is always selling that. And as a result, the performances of these two actors, but specifically of Elias Koteas, it really brings these characters to life. And it's such a fascinating, well-done performance that would have been phoned in by any typical beefcake guy that you would have gotten in that period of time. And instead, they went with an actor. And he acts... like he gives his all to it. Like that's one of the things with Elias Koteas, is there's not a lot of films that he phones in. Like he goes all out as Casey Jones and becomes so fucking likable and detestable at the same time. Like there's times you really want to smack the shit out of him, but you still dig him. He's that perfect kind of 80s anti-hero, which is what Casey Jones was based on to begin with. Like he was the riff on the vigilantes of the 80s. Like he was a riff on the
he's Bernie Getz.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, he's a low rent Batman. Like he's, you know, he's got his shtick, and his shtick is in the comics, he's half crazy. Like he's not just a good vigilante dude. He's kind of fucking nuts, and so nuts that he puts on a fucking hockey mask and puts a golf bag on his back and fills it with sports gear from his garage. And he goes and beats the shit out of bad guys.
Yeah.
Not just because he wants to clean up the city, but because he enjoys beating the shit out of people with sporting equipment.
He's more like he's less like Batman and more like Jim Carrey's character in Kick-Ass 2, where you're just like, oh, this person is just dangerously mentally ill.
Well, but that's because Kick-Ass, the Kick-Ass comics and the Kick-Ass movies were more in line with what the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles initially were. It was, we're taking the piss out of the comic book genre. We are having fun with the stuff that we think may have been overdone or gone too far. And so let's take the tropes and turn them on their ear and make a farce out of it. But here, this Casey Jones is much more down to earth, much more likable, and gets a love interest in April O'Neil, and their chemistry is actually really strong as well. Like as much as there's the very 80s artificial fighting early on with their relationship, by the time they kiss at the end of the movie, like that was when you were a kid, it was a stand up and cheer moment, even though this was a kissing film.
And he is responsible, by the way. If you want to complain about the violence in this movie, the single most violent act of any creature or human in this movie is Casey Jones casually murdering the shit out of Shredder at the end of this movie.
Oh, God. Oh, like, God. Casual as fuck.
Speaking of dangerously mentally ill.
Yeah. The oops.
Oops. I just, oh, my God. Like, if it's,
I just went and turned this on. Yeah.
I can't imagine. Like, I imagine, like, Jason Voorhees standing off to the side like, dude, that's hardcore. Like, because getting crushed.
No, he'd be like, dude, that's fucked up.
That is fucked up.
You getting just crushed him in a garbage truck.
Garbage truck. Like, I can't imagine a worse way to die. Like, it's just, oh, my God.
Well, the thing is, in the comic, and I forget if they did it
Eli
in the
Roth presents Casey Jones.
I don't remember if they did it in the cartoon or not. I'm not sure.
What, crush Shredder in a garbage truck?
No,
that did not happen.
What happens after he dies? Because I know in the cartoon that, like, I'm pretty certain I remember in the cartoon he dies in some way and comes back, but he's not really dead. But in the comic, one of the canisters was in the garbage truck and bursts open and gets on Shredder, and then the flies come and to devour him, and the maggots that are planted in him are affected by the ooze, and so the Shredder literally becomes a mass of living, mutated, conscious maggots. I mean, that's the comic.
This is why, as a fucked up child, I loved the action figures, because it was just like, oh, these are
all stuff
gross
like that.
And weird and goopy, and oh my God. I had the sewer playset that came with its own little like container of ooze that you could like dump through the pipes. Oh my God. So good.
True story. In my high school yearbook, my graduating year, there is a picture of me playing the stand-up Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle game.
Which, okay, we haven't even gotten to.
With the tagline, off on another turtle adventure, senior Chris Cargill plays video games at the local arcade.
Wait, is that what the CNC Robert Cargill stands for?
Yes.
I thought it was Cowabunga.
Cowabunga Cargill. God, I wish it was.
Yeah, Cowabunga Robert Cargill.
Man, I would have been much cooler and gotten much more play in the 80s if that were true.
Somebody's got a trip to the state licensing office coming up. But that fucking video game, the fucking sheer magnitude of the turtle phenomenon.
Do 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 do.
Phenomenon.
Do 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 do.
Phenomenon.
Do 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 do.
Did not stop at toys. Did not stop at T-shirts. Did not stop at movies. Like, they made countless video games, some of which are still heralded as some of the best video games ever made.
Oh, dude! Every time. Okay, so I live, as I've mentioned on the podcast before, I live in this very magical quadrant of Austin, Texas. Like, my buddy Scott came to town a few months ago, and he was like, every time I take him somewhere, he's like, this should not exist. You have a huge comic book store that is open till midnight every night. You have a pizza place named after Conan the Barbarian, covered in Frazetta art that makes amazing pizza, and you live walking distance from a 13,000 square foot stand-up arcade. Mm-hmm. And it's like, yeah, no, this neighborhood really exists. This is real.
And you buried the lead on that one. A stand-up arcade that is BYOB.
BYOB. And open till 2 in the morning on weekends. So, but every time...
And that does not stand for bring your own bubble bobble. That stands for bring your own booze, motherfuckers.
Every time you go in there during a busy night, you know, not like when you go at 3 in the afternoon when they open and there's like 12 people there.
Not like we would be doing right now if we weren't recording.
Yeah. But when you go in on a regular night, you cannot get on the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle machine. Like, there's always people playing that game. It is always because Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 2, Turtles in Time. These games are still so much fun today. Yeah. The NES Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle
so
game.
So hard, though. So good, so hard.
You know what? Until you're an adult and you watch a playthrough and you realize that you were just supposed to swim through the electric fences and not around it.
I mean, yeah, if you want to cheat at it, that's fine.
It's not cheating. That's how you were supposed to. That's what was so fucking hard. You were supposed to do that. But that game was fucking hard.
See, I just needed to drink more beer and look up playthroughs. That's the secret of the booze. Okay.
The secret of the booze.
Secret of the booze.
Oh, God. That should have been the name of our podcast. Why did we go with Junk Food Cinema? We could have been Secret of the Booze.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Podcast 2, Secret of the Booze. And people were like, what was the first one? There is no first one. Fuck off. Secret of the Booze. No, it's... okay. So we've talked a little bit about all these things that we like about this movie. Now, the things that are super... that are just super weird about this movie in terms of the overall history of film. First of all, this happens to be the first editing gig for Sally Menke, which some of you are like, what does that mean?
Sally Menke. That means a lot, especially when you talk about her first gig is on one of the most successful independent films of all time.
You think they gave her a taste for working on successful independent films and with successful independent filmmakers?
And with one of the most successful independent films of all time? Yes. Sally Menke, of course, is.
She is Quentin. She was. Unfortunately, she passed away, but she was Quentin Tarantino's editor up until the point that she passed away. Like, every film that he did while she was alive, she was his editor.
And there's a point at which you notice that Tarantino films got longer.
Mm-hmm.
It's because Sally Menke isn't around. She was the one person who could call Quentin on his bullshit and say, this is a really great scene, but it needs to go. It doesn't need to be here. But yeah, she did Res Dogs, Pulp Fiction.
She did everything.
Jackie Brown,
right up
Kill
until
Bill.
Inglourious Basterds, which is the movie a lot of people have complained and has started a trend in Tarantino movies where they are super long.
And she died tragically, too. She went hiking, which is something, you know, in LA, I know a bunch of people, they all go hiking up in the hills, and she just walked off the side of a cliff.
It's just...
It's terrible.
It's awful, because she really was, like, so much... I really do give her a lot of credit for what we know a Quentin Tarantino film to feel like, to flow like, to just like...
And here her editing is really spot on.
Really
she makes the emotional moments pop. She makes the fist-raising moments pop. She makes it look like these puppets are fucking ninjas.
That is the challenge, to take people who are operating under hundreds of pounds of foam and latex and cut the fight scenes in a way that isn't too choppy, but still gives the illusion that they are in full-on combat. And I think that's something that this movie does better, that does the best of the entire franchise. And I think a lot of that is credit to her. Also,
oh, here we go. The Foot Clan,
by the way, which operates like...
Which is, of course, a parody of The Hand.
The Hand.
The Daredevils.
The ninja organization from Daredevil.
Nemesis.
By the way, just a real quick rundown of this plot. This is sort of the rise of the Foot Clan in New York City, and they have been going on a crime spree where they're just stealing random shit. For what purpose, by the way?
To sell.
For what purpose, though? There's no master plan to this. Have you noticed that? Like, there doesn't... This is one of the few movies where the supervillain, Shredder, who, by the way, is a fucking badass, so cool, looks great, commands the room, but doesn't have an overall plot until his plot is kill the turtles.
Yeah, no, literally the plot of the villain has no mastermind plot. They're not they're just robbing people and selling illegal goods.
But he's raised, like, and then he trains all these orphans to be his ninja army who just keep stealing shit. But there's no
end game. That's actually, and you know, that's one of the cool things I really like about this movie is the lost boy nature.
Oh my God.
Of the young Foot Clan.
Well, that's why I keep calling him Fagin, is he's raising pickpockets
yeah.
into an army, and that's all he does. He doesn't have a mission or an overall scheme until the turtles show up, and he's like, these are freaks, I want to kill them. That's it.
No, that's not why. And that's what's kind of cool about this is it goes into classic like samurai movie tropes where he says there's something about the way you describe their fighting style that feels familiar, like it's a yeah. Darth Vader moment, like they're cribbing from Star Wars.
Not felt here. Since a weird rat was that's the big thing they changed from the cartoon to the movie is in the cartoon Hamato Yoshi himself gets exposed to the ooze and becomes Splinter. In the movie, Splinter was the pet of Hamato Yoshi, which is okay until you see the scene where they actually try and make you believe that he learned martial arts by watching his master when he was a rat and imitating the movements. First of all, why is a rat being kept in a bird cage? That's fucking weird. Secondly, why is a rat imitating like martial arts movement? Like, it would only make sense if he had already been exposed to amount of ooze.
None of this actually needs to make sense because it's called Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
But you already had something that made a lot more sense in the I was a martial artist who got transformed into a rat.
Speaking of modern minor flaws in this, if there's one thing that
I'm sure we could find a couple.
No. We've mentioned some, and we're going to continue to mention a few more. But
if we plumb the sewer, I'm sure we can find.
There's actually a moment where Splinter starts explaining his origin story again
for 15 years. And the movie cuts because Sally Mankey's a fucking genius. It goes, we don't need to hear this again
for 15 years now.
We got this. Thanks. Moving on.
But he actually explains his origin twice.
So in the scene where you see the hideout of the Foot Clan, which looks like basically pinballs on a Friday night. By the way, so much Burger King. Did you notice that?
Oh,
there's so much fucking Burger King in this movie.
Oh my God, this movie is one of those that was it was during that era where product placement had just become a big thing. And this movie's fucking loaded with it. Did you notice, as much as these guys love pizza, for some reason they're ordering only from Domino's?
If you were to watch this movie and that is all you knew of New York City, you would assume the only two restaurants in the Big Apple were Domino's Pizza and Burger King.
Yeah.
Which, don't get me wrong, is a reality I'm comfortable living in. But the point is, it's weird. But at the headquarters of the Foot is one particular orphan who seems to be in charge of ingratiating the new students.
Oh, yes.
He's not wearing the dragon doji yet. He's not a full-on member of the Foot Clan, but he's sort of the orientation specialist. And he's played by a young
Sam Rockwell.
Regular or mental. Oh, that's right, motherfuckers. If you only saw that movie a couple times and you're now remembering that kid is Sam goddamn Rockwell.
And that kid is encouraging other kids to smoke because it's 1990 and you could do that.
Yeah. Oh my God, I didn't even think of that. You could not fucking do that today.
No.
You can't do that scene. Handing cigarettes to children.
Sam Rockwell handing cigarettes to kids.
Wait a goddamn minute. Why is that not the thing that Jim Henson was complaining about? Why is that not the thing that made Judith Hogue not come back for the second movie? The violence? Fuck the violence. Sam Rockwell's handing out cigarettes to kids like it's fucking candy, and you're pissed off that there's rubber foot on ninja mask violence? I mean, I'll give you the Casey Jones thing. That is supremely fucked up. I get that. But Jesus, man, Sam Rockwell's trying to get kids hooked on cigarettes. That's fucked up.
That is a scene that happens in the movie.
Almost as fucked up as what this movie almost was. And this is something that blew my mind. So I actually went back recently and listened to comedian Gallagher's infamous episode of What the Fuck Podcast with Marc Maron. And if you haven't listened to this and you want to hear someone at the twilight of their career, who was only barely relevant to begin with, completely melt down, listen to that episode. Dude, you can find Gallagher, it on YouTube.
Gallagher got really racist.
He's racist, homophobic. He's just not a good dude. The thing is, on this podcast, he claimed at one point that he was most bitter about the fact that he never saw any money from them, those Ninja Turtles. And I was like, the fuck? He claimed that he had, at one point, the rights to the Ninja Turtles, could not get the movie made, ended up selling it all to Golden Harvest, and never saw a cent from like merchandising or anything, which is bullshit, because by the time the movie was made, the cartoon and the
they owned the shit out of the rights on this.
They had already been making money off that stuff. So there's no way Gallagher had it prior, right up to the movie being released. So bullshit called number one. But here's what I found out. One of the first attempts to convert the comic book into a movie was helmed by none other than our patron saint, our overlord.
Roger Corman?
Roger Corman.
Oh, I kind of want to see a Roger Corman Ninja Turtles movie.
Oh, you definitely want to see a Roger Corman Ninja Turtles movie when I tell you the concept. The concept was he was going to take four comedians who were popular at the time, put fake shells on them, and paint their skin green, and that was it. And they were just going to play Ninja Turtles as like fucking crazy comics with green skin. Those four comedians were Billy Crystal, Bobcat Goldthwait, Sam Kinison, and fucking Gallagher.
Oh, dear Christ.
So
you know that Gallagher would have been Michelangelo.
See, this is the game I want to play. This is the game I want to play. Which comedian is which turtle? I feel like Billy Crystal would have to be Leonardo just because he's the most... He's the most sane of that group.
Sam Kinison would be Roth.
Sam Kinison would be Raphael.
And then it's just, you know, you have...
I got it. Gallagher's a prop comic. He's an inventor. He would be Donatello. Bobcat Goldthwait is completely crazy. He would be Michelangelo. He would be the party dude. So Billy Crystal's Leonardo. Sam Kinison is Raphael because he's got the most angst. You have Bobcat Goldthwait as Michelangelo because he's the party dude doing enough coke to kill all of the horses. And then you have the prop comic inventor, Donatello, played by Gallagher. So I think he's misremembering details, but he's not.
I feel like that movie exists in the Shazam universe. I feel like that movie's out there in an alternate universe, and that universe
where
does.
Sinbad played one of the ninjas. Sinbad as Splinter.
That universe sucks, but. I'm not going to say that's a good universe.
You know what's really weird is there's a moment in this movie where Raph comes to after his beatdown coma, and he's like, what's a guy got to do to get some food around here? And he doesn't sound like the Raph in the rest of the movie. He sounds like Billy Crystal. It fucking weirded me out. As soon as I read that fact, that scene came on, and I was like, holy shit, Raph sounds like Billy Crystal. What is going on here?
I kind of want to see like your 90s version of the Ninja Turtles where, you know...
It's, oh, it is deranged.
Where he walks in, he's, could this pizza be any colder?
And they would all cut their pizza with scissors because I'm obsessed with 80s movies and that's what Cobra does. So, yeah, it would be a big, big fucking mess. But, yeah, that just fucking blew my mind that was almost the Ninja Turtle movies that we got. That was almost the first Ninja Turtles movie.
And instead, we got this wonderful, delightful, enjoyable little hot mess.
Yeah, because I actually like these turtles. Like, I like their interactions together. I think there is legitimate emotional weight to Leonardo sitting in that room and just watching the bathtub until Raph wakes up. Like, that's a very, like, you feel bad. And these are puppets that you feel bad for.
I do have to say, as much as you know, you can make a lot of jokes at Corey Feldman's expense, this does highlight that he's much better an actor with his physical presence than he is as a voice actor.
Oh, for sure.
Like, you hear his voice here and it just doesn't feel right because it's always clearly Corey Feldman and it didn't need to be.
Well, but they brought him back. They brought him back for the third one. They replaced him in the second one, but they brought him back for the third one, which I don't recommend watching. Like, I have a little bit of nostalgia for the second one, and that kind of carries me through to a certain point, but that second one is fucking garbage, and that third one is unwatchable.
Yeah.
So, this movie is a weird little...
Suits get worse.
How do they get worse? Just use the same fucking suits from the first one. How hard is that?
Because they probably didn't keep them.
Oh, you think Henson was like, those are mine? You don't.
Well, no, I mean, a lot of keep in mind that before, you know, nowadays, studios look at franchises, and when they make a movie and they feel it has a lot of potential, they'll sock stuff away. You know, they'll put stuff away in, you know, the Disney prop room in Marvel, where they keep a bunch of these props and they constantly rotate them to display them. And you can walk through and just look at all this cool stuff from like they had when I was there once, they had a bunch of the stuff from Lost. They literally had a whole shelf of the foodstuffs that were the props in the movies, you know, all the stuff from the organization and I was like, oh, this is really cool. But back then, when you're making an indie film, you don't have a studio behind you. It costs money to store this stuff. We're just making one movie.
Interesting.
If we make a second movie, we'll just go and want to rebuild them up because they may have taken damage anyway. You know, with Henson in particular, you know, one of the things that you see behind the scenes is there are pretty much 10 puppets for each puppet that you see on screen in case something happens to one of them so that they can quickly replace them because they get damaged. They get sweaty. So they may have just scrapped them, and Henson didn't come back. Did they come back for the second one? Did they?
He died.
He did, but yeah. Did Brian Henson come back for the second one?
No, he was probably like, fuck these guys. I'm not doing that again. But yeah, this is just, it's a movie that is, man, it is so much a product of so many different swirling spheres of pop culture. And
it's representative of
it. Yeah,
them.
It really is. And
it's also the one thing that should be noted is there's a few moments where it's a little uncomfortable with its orientalism, because it is the 80s.
Like anytime Splinter speaks, for example, would be something to
it falls upon a couple of uncomfortable tropes. It never gets truly offensive, but it is very 80s in that way of when people talk about cultural appropriation, there's a lot of it here. And while the comic was satirizing
Tatsu's entire existence, for another example,
yeah,
he doesn't serve a purpose other than to just be the angry Asian guy who, by the way, in the script and in the novelization and in, again, Sally Mankey, good job, originally he killed that student. Like in that scene where he just kind of bugs out and beats the shit out of that student, you hear the other students say, like, he's breathing, he's going to be okay. That was ADR, because in the original version, Tatsu straight up fucking kills a child in a ninja costume. Like, that is fucking insane. So, like, but they changed it, of course, to keep their PG rating. And that's the other thing that blows my mind, is that this is a PG movie. It's not even PG-13. All of the claims, like, it's too violent, it's too dark, and it's like, yeah, there's some heavy stuff in it that we've mentioned, but it's a fucking PG movie.
Well, keep in mind that martial arts was one of those things that was considered something that you could not necessarily show to kids. In fact, if I remember correctly, throughout the 90s, and it may still be today, but if you got kicked in the head, your movie got an R rating. Like, you could not kick someone in the head. Why? Because they didn't want kids kicking each other in the head.
I mean, I think that's how kids learn to not get kicked in the head.
This is just a thing that It was one of those ratings issues. And I'm not certain if that's still around or not, but that's for a long time. That was very much the case.
That's really interesting to me. But yeah, I mean, it's a movie that, yes, we do have a lot of nostalgia for, but is actually really interesting and really well done for what it is, and has such great effects, has really great editing, is shot really well, has characters that you like. It peppers in humor that's not only for adults in the sense that it's making reference to things that adults would know that kids wouldn't, but one of the weirdest jokes in the movie is Donatello calls Casey Jones a claustrophobic. And he says,
"Oh yeah,
are you crazy? I never even looked at another guy." And it's like,
that's inappropriate.
What now?
Yeah, that's the only. That's one of the. You're right. I meant to bring that up, because that really, I had forgotten that joke even existed.
You know, I had a lot of the action figures. I didn't have homophobe Casey Jones. I didn't get that one. There was a special limited edition, and it sold out before I could get one. But,
yeah, that's one of the inappropriate of its era jokes, and And he has to have claustrophobic explained to him.
Because he's just dumb. He's a crazy guy who lives... By the way, this movie establishes that he just kind of lives on rooftops and stalks criminals at night. So he is kind of that character from the comic book who's
he's
just
a little nutty. You know, deranged. What? One other little weird moment is that it becomes clear that April O'Neil actually owns that building.
Yeah.
And she lives above it and she owns the store and it's full of stuff that her dad had and she keeps it for him and the whole thing burns down.
And then they burn it down.
And that's really sad and you'd think that she'd be really broken up by that. No, not
really.
Well,
you know why? You know why? Because this bitch also has a house in the country. Like, I don't know how much money they're paying her. She makes a comment at the end of the movie that she's not a very high paid reporter. And I'm like, then how do you own an entire building in downtown and a house upstate? Like, that
well,
looks
this
like
is New York
graph.
City when New York City was crumbling. We've talked about this many times.
Oh, this is before I got rid of all the prostitutes. It was a terrible place to live. You could get an apartment for nothing. No, it was always expensive to live in New York. She owns an entire building. And then she complains like, oh, I'm losing money on this store just because I love my dad and I have a house upstate. And I'm just like, where's all this money coming from?
And then
from?
It burns the fuck down. To be fair, it's a rundown building.
I think here's what I think. I think April O'Neil is secretly the one behind the whole Foot Clan. They don't have any reason to be collecting all the money, right? No, they're paying April's rent. I'm just saying, guys, look at the facts. I'm just asking questions.
Wise man say, forgiveness is divine, but never pay full price for late pizza.
And that brings us to the junk food pairing, possibly the easiest junk food pairing we have ever done.
Of all time.
On any episode, but I will specifically say that, yes, it has to be Domino's Pizza, but what I find so funny about the fact that it's Domino's Pizza in the movie is it was Pizza Hut that paid $20 million to the makers of this movie so that they could license everything and do all the tie-ins in the restaurants. They're not even featured in the movie.
No.
They paid $20 million to not be featured in the movie.
Yeah.
That is crazy to me.
Yeah. But here is the thing. If it's going to be Domino's Pizza, you can put whatever you want on it, but no anchovies.
If you put anchovies on this thing, you're in big trouble, okay? There is not a line of this movie that I don't know. And it was crazy revisiting this because I was like, I revisited it a couple times recently because my stepson has started to get into Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and he wants to watch all the movies and it warms my heart, or that gooey, you know, black licorice place in my
chest.
Have
you shown him the 2007 animated one?
No, because I don't hate this kid. So,
I love that version.
I'm sorry. No, the 2007 one. No,
yeah.
That one's good. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that one's really good. You just stabbed me in the heart.
Whoa,
stop it.
Sorry about that.
That's a good one.
Sorry, but no, I thought you meant the Michael Bay ones, which I will never do. Because I do love this kid. I'm not going to ruin everything for him. But yeah, no, that will be the next one I show him. But I've shown him the first two, and he fucking loves it. And it makes me very happy. But revisiting it with him, I didn't I remembered every fucking line of this. I watched it so many times that it's burned into my brain. When TURTLE Power comes out at the end, I was like, oh, the half shells that the heroes for. In this day and age, you can ask for one where the crime wave is high, his mug is mysterious. All police and detectives are furious because they can't find the source of this lethally evil force. I could do the whole song.
I was thinking about that last night. How have you and I never done that song at karaoke?
It's going to happen.
It's going to happen at some point.
You know why? Because they don't have that song at karaoke.
Are you sure?
I'm not. We're going to have to investigate this 100%, and I'm going to have to buy back.
I feel like that's something that's probably always been at our karaoke joint, and we just
didn't think of it.
We just didn't think of it.
It's on us. And I can tell you what, once I start making a little bit more money, and I have space in my house, first thing I'm doing is I'm putting my collection of Turtles action figures back together, because holy shit do I love those things. And that's Junk Food Cinema, speaking of things we love. And you have been joining us for our TMNT episode. I hope you have enjoyed it.
Yeah. Quick shout out this week. Our buddies, we like to call them our sister podcast, 80s All Over with Scott Weinberg and Drew McWeeny. Their podcast, if you enjoyed us, you might enjoy them. They're pretty awesome. And they're doing a Patreon right now and getting things moving so that they can afford to keep doing that on the regular.
Which we can appreciate.
With lots of benefits to get from their Patreon.
They go through the 80s 1 month at a time. And if you want to know why we
starting
call them with
in January 1980.
And why we call them our sister podcast is the first two movies they cover, Can't Stop the Music and The Changeling.
Yep. They literally just, they watch every movie that is of note that released that month. They go through the month, and you really kind of get a sense. It's really great for discovering forgotten gems and movies that if you're my age, you're like, oh shit, I haven't seen that since I was a kid. To other times where you're like, oh shit, how have I never heard of this movie? I need to go find this right now. And it is, it's a great podcast. If you're looking for another podcast, if you need another podcast, it comes highly recommended from us. If you don't need another podcast, just check out our Patreon.
Patreon.com/junkfoodcinema. We are in the process. Actually, I'm in the process of putting together an additional patron exclusive podcast just for people who subscribe to this one. And it's going to be pretty fucking spectacular. But speaking of the internet, Cargill, where can people find you on it?
You can find me on Twitter at twitter.com/massaworm. That's MASSAWYRM. And on Facebook, facebook.com/massaworm.
Awesome. You can find me on Twitter at Bri Guy Salisbury or on Facebook, facebook.com/BrianSalisburyCritic. Definitely check out our Patreon. And I'm going to close out the show by reminding you to strike hard and vanish without a trace, which is also actually how I approach eating at the Golden Corral. Just throwing that out there.